having a psychologically safe environment that allows people to bring their diverse perspectives to the table. And that's the only way that you can negotiate a ground that allows the people who want one thing to peacefully cohabitate and work together and collaborate, and really collaborate with those who may have different sets of priorities and different preferences. So for me, that's where I always start is, you know, when I go and I work with lots of organizations on these sorts of things and thinking about culture and how do we build it. And I can see on your bookshelf, lots and lots of, you know, great books around the importance of culture. I'm a huge believer in culture as one of the biggest determinants of organization success. But making sure that that culture is one that values and accepts different opinions and makes people feel they can bring those opinions to the surface. It's not trivial, but it's really, really important.
Welcome to the Leading Transformational Change Podcast. Our passion is to help you lead and develop organizations with a remarkably healthy culture that can positively impact all of its stakeholders. Every other Thursday, we drop hour-long conversations with world-leading researchers and experts on culture, ethics, change, and leadership. My name is Tobias Sturesson, and I'm your host and the co-founder of Art Management. How do we build culture in a hybrid or fully remote work reality? I've gotten that question countless times in my conversations with leaders and HR professionals over the last 2 years. And I'm really sure that many of you have asked yourself that question too. The pandemic has, of course, greatly impacted how organizations gather, and in doing so, it has also wreaked havoc on many culture initiatives since they're typically built around several physical events or workshops. However, I believe there's an opportunity here. While these type of sporadic events can have an important impact, they have really very little sway over the thousands of explicit and implicit messages constantly coming through the voice of leadership, decision-making, and processes signaling to the culture what is valued, rewarded, or not accepted in the organization. So, not having been able to put all the focus on a few physical gatherings or corporate retreats, organizations have hopefully had an opportunity to think through what values and behaviors are actually promoted through their stories, their rituals, and their processes. However, living in a hybrid or fully remote world can pose a lot of other challenges. How do we, for example, create equity in hybrid meetings? How do we make sure that we have equal opportunities for development and promotion? And is that even possible when we're not all in the same place? How do we create psychological safety when we don't get to meet physically? I had the great pleasure of sitting down with Mark Mortensen, who's a world-leading expert on these topics. Mark is an associate professor of organizational behavior at INSEAD in Paris. His area of expertise is organizational collaboration with an emphasis on globally distributed virtual and project-based work. In his research, he has investigated the nature of conflict in distributed collaboration and its relationship to identity, context, and communication. His research has been published in numerous outlets such as the MIT Sloan Management Review and The Economist. His recent Harvard Business Review article with Professor Amy Edmondson on what psychological safety looks like in a hybrid workplace is really an essential read. While so many people have lots of opinions on to what extent leaders should or shouldn't allow hybrid or remote work, Mark and I focused on discussing both the benefits and the challenges, and how we can have safe conversations within our organizations on how we do our best work. We also touched on the impact of the tragic ongoing invasion in Ukraine and how Mark's upbringing influences his work and thinking. So without further ado, let's jump into my conversation with Mark Mortensen. Mark, it's really a privilege to have you on the podcast today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
So I wanted to start by asking you a bit more personal question, something that we normally do on this podcast. And of course, it has to do with your professional journey. But what brought you into management research and then consecutively, what kind of led to your focus on organizational behavior and distributed models of collaboration and so on?
I guess I should start by saying I didn't start off wanting to be study psychology or study organizational behavior. My training is as an engineer. So I'm a recovering or fallen computer scientist. And I spent a good bit of time working. I spent some time working with KTH, Keteho, doing some work trying to design basically video, Skype before Skype and Zoom before Zoom, video over TCP/IP way back in the day in ancient history. And it was actually, honestly, in that project that as I was working on this stuff, I started noticing that where things broke down was very rarely with the technology. I mean, technology broke down because it was new, but where things got really interesting was when the human dynamics broke down. And I think the most perfect example of that was when I finally got to go and visit my counterparts on the other side of this video link. I've been seeing them weeks after weeks, months after months. And what you needed to know was on my end, our production room was a wiring cabinet. There were two racks of servers. There was a table that didn't actually fit flat. So it had to sit sort of on an angle, wedge between them in California, in a room with no air conditioning and racks of servers. So it was really hot and you sat there and you were sweating and there was just enough room for you and the two people next to you to kind of fit in. And on the other end, I discovered it was a giant conference table that had coffee served on the side and everything else. And all of a sudden, I realized why everybody on the other side of the link wanted to have much longer meetings than I did, because they were happy. They were having the best time of their day. Me, I was miserable and hot and uncomfortable. So it was experiences trying to build technology and work in a distributed fashion that really got me thinking that's where I wanted to spend my time and effort. So I just sort of switched my focus. But one thing that comes clear, I think, in a lot of my research, I still see people, I think of them as systems. I think of organizations as social systems. And a lot of the rules that I learned in trying to study and understanding technical systems actually apply really well. It's just that the agents in the system have a little bit more noise. They unfortunately have free will and sometimes do things you don't expect. But a lot of the same principles really hold. So that's kind of what led me on this bizarre journey to now be a professor in a business school studying organizational behavior and new ways of work.
Wow, that is so many things there that we could unpack. And I just really love that journey that you shared. And I think it relates to mine. I come from the background of working with communication and communication strategy within more marketing, but realized, I guess, a similar thing that many times organizations try to kind of fix their issues through marketing methods, but that there were underlying issues in terms of like, who are we, where are we going, and so on, that weren't really dealt with. And you're based in Paris, right?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So, before we go into the subject, which I really want to talk to you about today, about the different ways of working, of course, we are in an incredibly special and strange and sad time. And we had our last podcast episode was with Sergei Boltschuk, a leader in Ukraine, who is now trying to evacuate his people from their facilities and evacuate people with disabilities and so on. And my wife is Ukrainian and she's the co-founder of our company. So this is very, very close to my heart. And I'm just thinking in terms of being in Paris, being in Europe, what is kind of the mood there right now?
And I think in most of the world, I think the view is looking on with a mix of shock and horror and disbelief. My parents both came through World War II. My mother is a war refugee. My father helping to smuggle people out, actually in fishing boats from Denmark up to Sweden. So it's amazing it's amazing and sad and really kind of hard to fathom that we're you know, we're looking at war in Europe in a way that we haven't been thinking about it. You know, and I, there's, this is obviously a very big political conversation about what's already happened, and whether it's Crimea or, you know, there's lots of things going on and lots of other instances throughout the rest of the world where people, I think, are rightly saying, hey, stuff like this is going on in our backyard as well. As the child of two career UN employees, I'm a very big believer in peace and negotiation and conversation and finding other ways around it. I desperately hope that, you know, it's not easy, and you know, everything from trying to balance out needs and demands, and you know, how do you deal with somebody who's completely irrational, and yet you still have to deal with them? Otherwise, you can't just ignore it, and you can't just steamroll over it. So it's a very tough situation, and, you know, heart goes out to all of those who are directly affected, with family members as you are, and all of us as just people dealing with what's currently going on, and fear and concern about what could happen coming down the pipe.
And I think this relates actually to our topic, and I guess everything is interconnected in some way. And I think, as you said, I mean, it's been something that kind of gave me pause as well over this last weeks, as people in my kind of environment have reached out to me. Of course, I've heard their stories of escaping war in Afghanistan, escaping war in Lebanon, in Syria, and so many different places. And I, of course, I've never been able to understand it more than what I have today, in terms of having that much closer relation to the country and to the situation. But of course, all of this is also something that we bring into the workplace. And I think, as it seems in my part of the world, we seem to be largely on the other side of the pandemic. And I think actually the war has kind of helped in that sense, in that respect, that suddenly we're not talking about infection rates anymore in Sweden, because there are so much, I don't know, you don't want to compare things, but there are other things to worry about.
Sure.
And of course, there are still countries in the world that are experiencing high levels of infections. But I think in Sweden, where, I mean, we're seeing that a lot of people are returning to their offices, and still, however, the way we work has likely changed forever. And as you work so much in this field, I first just wanted to ask you, as you look into the future, and I guess look to the present, what do you see is happening in terms of how we are and how we will be collaborating?
Look, I think it's a great question, and I'll start, or I'll premise it by saying, anybody who tells you they know what the future is, you know, you should take that with a very big grain of salt. I've been studying how work and things are changing for over 20 years, and I don't know what the future is going to be. I have predictions. You know, early on, I was sort of hyping, hey, this whole hybrid thing, I think hybrid is going to be the way things are going. And that's turned out to be pretty accurate. And everybody's focused in and jumping on the hybrid bandwagon. In terms of where, you know, where things are going, the best way I would put it is, I think we need a tempered view of what's to come. And what I mean by that is, on the one hand, look, there are lots of people who are very heavily promoting forever after, work will never be the same. We will work from anywhere. I am never going to wear pants again in my life, because now all things are video from the chest up, and that's it. And I can work on a beach, and I can blur my background, and I can digitally make myself anywhere I want to be. And all of those things are true. Those are all possibilities. And I think one of the things that the pandemic has shown us is it forced a lot of people and organizations over, or even straight through, a learning curve much faster than they were naturally going. Again, as having studied this for a long time, this is not new. We have been doing more and more remote working for a long time. It's been ever increasing. And technology is facilitating that, and a lot of other things. But we did this all of a sudden at scale, very fast, and it became, we all have to do it. And we don't, in a certain respect, we don't care, or we ignore the potential downsides and costs. We're just going to do it. And lo and behold, many of us discovered, us being either individuals or organizations, it's actually working all right. It hasn't been as terrible as we thought. People are actually pretty functional. I mean, look at academics as a prime key example. academics are known and very often are very, very stubborn in terms of making these sort of adjustments and changes. And one of the things that I think we saw is we were forced to make the changes and now have sort of accepted, I guess we actually can do this. It's working all right. So I think what we need, as I said, is a tempered view. It's not going to be everything remote forever and ever and ever. It's also not going to be right back into the office the way things have been. It's going to be somewhere, some combination of the two. And I think we need to start taking a little bit more of a nuanced view of that going forward.
That's so, so helpful. And I think that some managers that I've talked to, they make the case that hybrid or remote work was meant to be a temporary situation. And they're a bit frustrated with employees assuming that this now should be the new normal. I mean, it wasn't anything that they promised. It wasn't anything that they set out to. It was a temporary situation.
Right.
And I've heard some of them kind of venting frustration with employees who become a bit perhaps too comfortable not having to travel to work, or who can now kind of do their laundry whenever they want to, or who are perhaps saying they don't feel comfortable in a public environment, even though the vaccination rate is high and there's not a high infection rate. And so what is your perspective on that line of thinking?
Look, I see both sides of the issue, or both sides of the equation. And I think, and there's some work I'm doing right now with Amy Edmondson and Rob Cross, where one of the things we're talking about is what is the employee value proposition now, and how do we think about that? And one of the things that I think is important to recognize is it shouldn't be a conversation of, look, the employees versus leadership, right? Leadership says you should be back in the office. Employees say, we don't want to be back in the office. Look, back in the office has pros and cons for employees and for leaders. Nothing comes for free. Nothing is universally good. What I think we really need is we need better conversations between employees and leadership to help understand what's going on. Why is it when leadership says, and there have been a number of instances, there's some very high visibility examples in the finance world, for example, of organizations saying, you need to get back in the office. We need you back in the office. That's not just for fun. That's not because leadership is saying, let's make our people suffer more. That's actually saying, look, we really think there is a value that we are able to gain being in the office together. And that in from one standpoint is around productivity and what they're able to deliver, but it's also other factors. And I think one of the things that I am seeing, and I think is something that people have to be careful about, when you hear that line about saying, look, you know, those out of date leaders want everyone back in the office, but I'm super productive working at home and it's so much better. And the only reason they're saying that is because they're old and they don't get it. And admittedly, look, I've got a lot of white in my beard. I'm one of the old guys. I get that. But I also know we have a lot of research on human basic biology about the way in which we interact with people, about the benefits of things like social support, about the types of informal interactions. And if there's anybody who has studied how to generate informal interactions, how to create bonds and connections over distance, everything, believe me, I am full in on that. But it is not the same. And I think what we do have to be careful about is, on all sides, the benefits that we get from remote working, we have to recognize those are typically short-term benefits. They're immediate benefits. It's great. We are right now doing this podcast. My family is upstairs. My three-year-old came home from school a couple of hours ago. As soon as we're done, I can go upstairs and I'm immersed in her world and I can have a great family moment. That is absolutely a benefit. But I also have to remember that I'm losing something by not being in the office. That could be some random conversations with colleagues. That could be just a general sense of feeling connected to my work and its purpose and what I do and those sorts of things. And so I think what we really need is we need better, more open conversations about what it is that we as employees want and need, what organizations want and need, and the unexpected, often unseen costs of either decision, whether it's forcing people back in the office and saying, we're taking back some of the autonomy that you felt you had gained. That's a very big loss for people. Whether that is people saying, I'm going to work from home, and they don't spend time and they don't get to bump into Tobias at the coffee machine and you get to find out about, oh, what did you do yesterday? Oh, tell me about this. How's your family doing? How's your wife's family doing? All of those sorts of things we don't get. And one of the things that I've said for many, many years, when it comes to being remote, we have to pay for many of the things that used to come for free. The stuff that we'd pick up by just walking around, seeing things, interacting with people, suddenly that stuff doesn't just happen. We have to start manufacturing it. And that comes with a cost. So that was a kind of a long-winded answer around a lot of those things. But I think it's not an easy answer. But I think that I caution people to be cynical, or maybe cynical is not the right word. I caution people to be skeptical about the pundits on either end, the ones who say all remote all the time, the ones who say all back in the office all the time. How about we have a conversation, because we're going to get to a better end result?
Yeah, and that's so incredibly helpful. And I think that there's been a lot of talk about the great resignation, and I've read, and as I'm sure that you have, countless posts proclaim that unless companies give their employees freedom to choose where they work from, they're going to leave. And what I feel, and I think you've already kind of stated that it's easy that we overlook, of course, there are many benefits, but that we also overlook some of the challenges with hybrid work. Like, I think one of the things that I think about, for example, and I read a great article on that by a researcher, and now I don't remember who it was or what the name of it was, but just about the aspect of equity, that if you have managers who are more likely to be office based, and then you have some employees who are as well, and then others who won't be there, that the managers might not have the training or the systems kind of needed to be able to give them equal opportunities. And you've said, and I think this is a really, really interesting conversation, because of course we have, if we say we're like fully working in the office, and then we have companies that are fully remote and that have always been fully remote in that sense. Like, I think one example that has been very, very much up on the radar now is Automattic, the company that builds the WordPress website platform. And then of course we have the hybrid model. And I think you've said that the hybrid work is the hardest option. Can you talk a little bit about those and what are the distinctives and what are maybe some of the positives and the challenges?
On the article, I'm not sure which one you read, but it could have been mine. I actually wrote a piece with Martin Haas around fairness within a hybrid environment. One of the things that we highlighted, as you were saying, is one of the things, and this sort of dovetails with where your question went, one of the things that makes hybrid so particularly difficult is it's not just half and half. It's not just somewhere in between. You have new challenges, like if you were working in the office Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and I'm working in the office Monday, Wednesday, Friday, that's great. We see each other 3 days a week. We have 2 days a week that we aren't physically face-to-face. That's fine. But if you're the big boss and I have the same schedule as you do, and somebody else is working, but they're working Monday, Tuesday, Thursday, I have 66% more face time with the boss than they do in terms of those 3 days. That's not trivial. And if a leader isn't really consciously thinking about how do I make sure that this remains fair, et cetera, that's where hybridity itself adds in a layer of complexity around things like equity and fairness, definitely. We know it has some very big impacts for things like not just equity, but diversity and inclusion and those sorts of things. It can be harder to build psychological safety, which is also some work I've done with Amy Edmondson, which has very direct links to your feeling connected, being able to bring your honest, true self to work. The more safe you feel, the more you're willing to share and express what matters to you and be honest about that. One of the things that I hope will happen and I encourage to happen is, look, you're also going to see a bit of a diversification in the labor market. There are absolutely some people who say, I want to work from home, fully remote all the time. That's it. That's it for me. I placed my bets. I'm in. Now, all the things we talked about before still hold. They may be undervaluing something that they may only find out in a couple of years' time. We've polled a lot of people. And whenever I ask people, do you feel more or less connected to your organization than you did before you started working more remotely. These are to people who've typically gone much more remote. The almost universal answer is, I feel a lot less connected. Now, COVID is a big messy noise producer in that whole equation, but at least stands to, at least should drive a question. Is this something more about the way in which we're working remotely? Now, maybe you say, that's totally fine. I don't even care about that. I'm fine being sort of arm's length with my employer and fine. It's great if there are some employers that are designed to work that way, in which case you can say, look, when I'm looking and I'm looking to try to decide where I want to work, right? We know that employee fit, person organization fit is one of the most important determinants of career success. Having organizations out there that are fully remote for the people who want to work remote is great. We also need some organizations that have offices and face-to-face for the people who actually like that. There are people out there who say, look, no, I want to be in an office. So what I'm hoping, and I think we will see eventually over time, is we'll see a bit of a segmentation of the market. There are peer organizations. If you are in professional service firms, there are going to be some that gravitate towards more heavy remote, some that gravitate towards more face-to-face. And that is going to become increasingly part of the criteria you use in selecting the organization you want to be in. I think, again, though, what's important to recognize is that whole discussion around the Great Resignation and sort of the how do we land our employees, employee retention is only one piece of the puzzle. You need to optimize that, but you also need to optimize on your ability to deliver. Can you actually deliver in this mode of working? And what about those long game things like organizational culture, dynamics, mental health, isolation and loneliness, equity and fairness, all the things that are more the social dynamics that emerge over time and evolve over time. You have to think about all of those different buckets at the same time, which is part of what makes it very difficult.
That's so helpful. And I'm thinking one maybe piece of the puzzle is that, and it's something, and of course, this is very, very anecdotal evidence, but I've done like workshops with leaders where we ask them, so what are kind of, are there ways in which your values kind of have changed, that there were things that were more important for you, like before the pandemic, that are less important now and vice versa? And I don't have any data on at all on the extent of this, but I'm thinking that perhaps that, of course, organizational purpose is incredibly important. It's something that we talk a lot about on this podcast. We have some great conversations on that. And of course, it's very important that it actually becomes something that is true of us, not just some nice words that we say. But I think maybe something has been in the culture of kind of wanting to create this environment where we get people's kind of total engagement into our objective and our mission, and where maybe some people have felt, yeah, but there's a mission in terms of my family, and that I've realized over this time that it's importance more. I mean, I remember in one group where someone were just sharing a really heartbreaking story of her grandmother and how she weren't able to visit her because of the COVID restrictions. And then when it finally opened up so she could visit her, she contracted COVID and died. So she never had that opportunity to hug her grandma. And I just think of those examples in terms of those relationships that are kind of outside of work.
I mean, there's no question that many, many, many people have done some very personal reprioritization and rethinking of what matters to them. I mean, the most by far, when you ask people, why is it that you want remote work? By far the most common answer I hear is, look, it's time with my family, right? I was in that hamster wheel running and 9 to 5 and always, you know, always traveling and everything. And then COVID hit and I had to spend all this time at home, and then realized there's a reason I have this whole family. I love them. They're great. It's wonderful. It's enriching. I'm better. I'm happier. I'm more, all sorts of things. So I think when we talk about things like purpose, I mean, individual people have done a lot of rethinking, and I think that there's no question about that. These are pendulums. They will swing. Right now, I think that is much more top of mind than it had been for a while. But in history, there are times when we move in one direction or another. I have no doubt that as the pandemic goes further and further in the background, the lure of bouncing around and doing these great projects may pull some more people back into that mindset. I think there's a broader or an additional piece around organizational purpose and recognizing what role that plays in our desire to choose to join or stay with a given organization. I think, and again, this really ties in very much to the work I'm doing with Amy Edmondson and Rob Cross, where we're really seeing you need a broader, better view of that employee value proposition, one that isn't just focused in, where I think a lot of us have been in recent history, in last couple of years, we've been so focused on the flexibility and that as the number one only thing that is the most important, that I think one of the things that a lot of organizations are going to have to do is start taking a step back and saying, yeah, but that's not the only piece of the equation, right? People don't only work for a company for the material things it provides. They work for it for other reasons. And there are other things that need to get factored in there, whether it has to do with purpose or other elements as well. And that's part of what I think organizations need to be thinking about. That's part of why we're really diving into that and studying it and talking to a lot of organizations about it.
And I really want to talk to you about how we can have that conversation around this, because I think that is such an important, and I know that many of our listeners, leaders, HR, and even I think ethics professionals really think about these questions. And I'm thinking it's not only a pandemic that has kind of hit us the last 2 years. I mean, it's been, if we look from a US context, and I think the same is true in certain part of Europe, we've had a really difficult political season. There has been a lot of where we're in a situation where families are divided because of political allegiances, maybe in a way that they weren't before. We're in a place where employees are perhaps more and more calling for their employers to stand up on certain issues and kind of raise their voices on things that are aligned with values that are important to them. And of course, I think something about this current crisis in terms of Ukraine and Russia is that in our Western world, if I think from a Swedish context, for example, and I think it's largely true for the US as well, that it feels like we have this like good versus evil, where there's like where it's kind of some type of clarity, shared clarity. Of course, it's not everyone, but there's a certain sense of shared clarity on the values we stand for. And there's a lot of talk about, for example, that the European Union is more kind of united than ever. And I think there's a certain relief in that's because so much over these last years have been so toxic and so hard to know like how you navigate and where the distinctions are really hard and where we know that a family member, that somebody, which is of course true with Ukrainians now, we have family members in Russia, but anyway, so it was a long winded road to get to the question. But what I wanted to say is that, I mean, it's not just the pandemic. There's been a lot of things going on that I think have made conversations within organizations harder, because there have been just, maybe we're asking something from our organization that we're not seeing. We have more and more walkouts and things like that. So how can organizations kind of have that conversation in a way that respects people's emotions and values? And like you said, maybe it's a value. I see the importance of being at home with my family, and at the same time takes into account what they believe. Not only, of course, is good for the business, but that is actually also good for their employees and their need of social life and so on.
You're asking, I mean, it's a fantastic question, and it's a very real challenge. I guess, so forgive me for being overly academic for a second. I think, in my mind, there are two ways you solve this problem. One is you create homogenous organizations, right? One way that we can avoid these difficult conversations is by saying, look, we are so clearly on one side of whatever issue. And so now I'm stepping, obviously wading into the political foray of everything gets very messy. I think I'm in the same mindset as you are in that the world in general has been much more polarized of late. Again, as the child of diplomats, that bugs me. That I want people to have conversations. But one way, right? I mean, if you think about it, a very, very heavily purpose-focused organization has a very big benefit. And this may sound negative, I don't mean it this way, but it's a very big benefit in terms of aligning people, in terms of saying, look, we believe 1,000% that this is the only thing that matters. Value is defined by this, and we are 100% aligned on that. That makes your work and your life a lot easier because you don't have to have as many debates because, look, we all know, we live, we breathe, we think this is the right answer. There's a real value to that. And that's not a bad thing. It's a choice though, right? That you say, look, we're going to do that. And the downside is when you have one perspective, that's fantastic as long as that perspective is right. That perspective makes it harder for you to take on different sides of any issue, whatever that might be. The flip is you say, look, we embrace the fact that we have people in this organization with very different priorities. That could be some people who say, look, it's profit, profit, profit. It's the only thing that matters. Other people who say, look, I'm here because it's about building relationships and connections and community. That's what matters. Others who say, no, this is all about growth. It's about development. It's about learning. There are lots of different ways that you can slice purpose and what you're doing and how you're thinking about it. For me, the healthiest organizations, but not the easiest organizations, are the ones in which you accept and own that diversity of approaches and thoughts and prioritizations, et cetera. And you put in the significant time and effort to facilitate those conversations. And that comes back to, you know, you were sort of saying, so how do we do that? Trite as it sounds, I'm going to come back to Amy again. Amy Evanson's work on psychological safety is, to me, some of the most important work that we have in recent history when it comes to organizational psychology and understanding this. It's such a simple thing to focus on. And again, for those who are, just to clarify, for those who aren't as familiar with Amy's work and the work on psychological safety in general, psychological safety means that feeling that I can speak my mind without fear of reprisal, that you're going to say, well, but Mark, that was stupid. And not only was that stupid, that means I think you're stupid and that's going to affect you and your career, et cetera, et cetera. Amy has incredible data on everything from cockpit flight crews and surgical teams about how important it is to get better quality outcomes to have those open discussions. What psychological safety is not is avoid all the nasty topics. It's exactly the opposite. The knee-jerk reaction, people say, oh, but psychological safety means you never talk about anything serious. You keep everything fluffy and light. And that's not true. It's the exact opposite. It's saying I'm able to say, hey, Tobias, I really think you are flat wrong on that. And here's why. And you won't take it personally. And I won't judge you based on that. I think that psychological safety is one of the most critical things. And we have data on this. You know, Google's work looking at team effectiveness. It's one of the two top drivers of effectiveness is having a psychologically safe environment. That allows people to bring their diverse perspectives to the table. And that's the only way that you can negotiate a ground that allows the people who want one thing to peacefully cohabitate and work together and collaborate. And really collaborate with those who may have different sets of priorities and different preferences. So for me, that's where I always start is, you know, when I go and I work with lots of organizations on these sorts of things and thinking about culture and how do we build it? And I can see on your bookshelf, lots and lots of, you know, great books around the importance of culture. I'm a huge believer in culture as one of the biggest determinants of organization success. But making sure that that culture is one that values and accepts different opinions and makes people feel they can bring those opinions to the surface it's not trivial, but it's really, really important.
I just love that you say that, Mark. And I think, I mean, for regular listeners to this podcast, it is something that we've been having so many conversations on, from everything with whistleblowers to Mary Gently about giving voice to values, and Jim Dietert on courage and so on. So I really love that you bring up the topic of psychological safety and Amy's work, because I do truly believe that it is the most, I mean, one of the most absolutely most fundamental aspects of a healthy culture. And yet we see so many times that we don't have that environment where people feel really safe to bring up uncomfortable conversations. We just had a study come out recently in Sweden where a union had done a study on employees in state organizations in Sweden, so in public organizations, where 30% said that they were afraid to bring up criticism because of a fear of reprisals. And I don't really think that a lot of people understand how dangerous that is. It's dangerous from an ethical perspective because I would guess that it's one of the absolute top most important factors of building a more ethical culture, that people are free to speak up. But of course, also from so many different factors, as you've already raised.
I agree with you. And what I would echo, because it's interesting. I had last summer, I was part of a podcast put on by the New York Fed, the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And it was all about culture, in particular culture around ethics and things like whistleblowing. And so we had a fascinating conversation around it, a fascinating discussion about it. One of the things that I think is really important, I just want to flag this, and sorry for interrupting, but is to me, when it comes to also things like ethics, when it comes to things like conduct and how do you promote good conduct and how do you encourage whistleblowing if there's an infraction, all this sort of stuff. You need, to me, culture is the tool to do it rather than rules. I'm not saying you don't need rules. You absolutely need rules because look, one of the challenges of culture is culture has baked in ambiguity and uncertainty and it has fuzzy boundaries. You do need rules that say, no, but this, you can't do that, right? This is absolutely out of range. You can't do it. But the problem is if you rely only on rules, you run into a few different problems. Number one, you better come up with a rule for every possible eventuality out there. Because if you miss one, right, what do rules do? They train us to make sure that we don't, it's like building a fence. A fence is only as good as the consistency of the fence. If you put in 99 panels of a fence between two different yards and you leave one out, the dog is going to find that one hole. Opening and walk straight through, and it the fence is useless. So you need, so the problem is if you train the dog that the fence is what stops them from going in the neighbor's yard, you better make sure that fence is perfect. But if you train the dog that you're not allowed to go in the neighbor's yard, and you train the dog that that's what you do, then even if there's a hole in the fence, the dog may stop and go, well, but I'm not supposed to do that. Now, ignore the dog analogies. We have a new puppy, so that's probably top of mind for me. But one of the challenges is culture is a much better tool for the halo effect that it gets you. And it's much more effective at stopping bad behaviors before they happen, rather than much more costly having to police and then rectify when something gets done wrong or goes in the wrong direction. And so that's why I'm a very big believer, and I think especially with topics around ethics and compliance and conduct, culture is the most powerful tool, but it's not easy.
And so now I just have to kind of jump into this conversation and because I mean, just what you were just talking about. And I want to get back to psychological safety then and into psychological safety in a hybrid environment. But I think one of the things that managers have and HR leaders have said to me is that they struggle with thinking, oh, how do we kind of do work on our culture when we've been now in this situation where we're working remotely and so on. And as I've been thinking about that, I think that so many times leaders and HR professionals put focus in terms of when they think about working on their culture, which in one sense is a strange concept because we're always, I mean, affecting our culture in some way. But anyway, doing an intentional culture effort, they build that on events. They build that on the kind of corporate annual retreat. And you think when we can't have that, when we can't meet in that way, then we can't really affect our culture. And what I've been trying to say is that, I mean, culture is very much built right through the rituals, the stories, and the processes and systems that kind of send signals of what is appreciated, what is rewarded in this environment. So in one sense, you could say this is a good situation because we could actually look past all of the events and actually look at what behavior are our processes, what behavior are our rituals whenever we meet, whether that is digitally or whatever. What are the rituals that actually affect behavior and decision? So I just wanted to hear your point on that before we go back to psychological safety.
So I'm a big fan of Ed Schein's work on culture. As a former colleague of mine when I was at MIT, and Ed has done this amazing work that beautifully simplifies down what I think, you know, what we need to care about, right? Ed talked about culture as being sort of three main levels. You have the artifacts on top. These are the concrete things you see, the espoused values, the things people talk about, and then the underlying assumptions that nobody ever talks about. But honestly, that's what shapes your real behavior. What something as simple as Ed's model, I think, helps us with for now is, look, the reality is, culture is shaped by and directed by reinforcing events. It's the thousands, it's not the big, I mean, let's be honest, it's not the giant all hands meeting where you put up some flashy things and say, look, now we care about integrity. And everyone goes, sure, whatever, and goes back. And, you know, they okay, did we get a free t-shirt? No, mugs this time? Fine, great. And then they go back home. That doesn't do, you know, it's a signal. It is one data point towards, hey, the organization cares about integrity. What is much more of a driver of a culture of integrity or compliance or whatever else is the thousands of little things. Are there, whether it's things that are baked into your emails and the messaging, the language that we use on a daily basis, whether we have touch points, whether we have processes that make us check in and make us take time to reflect, whether or not we have social structures to support people who are engaged, who may whistleblow or not, whether we share, you mentioned stories, right? Culture is shared and transmitted through shared experience, but you can't always be there. Stories are a way to share experience over time and over distance. So what do? You share stories. And what do you share stories about that amazing hero of the organization who took the proud, brave leap to stand up. You tell the stories about the person who was let go, even though they were the highest earner in terms of bringing in revenue, because they were doing something that was not okay and toxic. Yeah. And even though we lost a lot of money, it was more important for us to stay true to our values. Those repeated, recurring things are infinitely more powerful in terms of generating and maintaining and shaping culture than any big event that you can't do because you're virtual. Doesn't mean that virtual doesn't have a role here. Of course it does. What do you lose? You know, one of the things when you're not physically there, you can't see where my space is. You don't see whether there's a poster with the values over there. You don't see whether or not we are, you know, I'm treating my coworkers well, or you do lose a lot of data when you are working remotely. And like I said before, you have to pay for that stuff. Used to come for free. Now you have to find ways to transmit that. You have to be more proactive and ask. But it's not about the big events. It's about the consistency among the messages over and over and over. And the last thing I'll say on this, consistency is only, it's like the fence analogy. It's as strong as its weakest link. If you say day in and day out, we care about ethics, we care about how we treat people, we care about this, care, 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 care. The one person who acts in contrast to that, the bully who is abusive and is allowed to get away with it because they're friends with the boss, because they bring in a lot of money, because they're too senior and we can't say anything, because they're too junior and we can't say anything, whatever it is, that one infraction breaks all of those messages you were trying, because it shows that they don't actually carry. Consistency is the tool of culture. You've got to be able to create it, and you've got to create that even in a virtual environment.
Amen to that. That's so helpful. So let's then take the conversation back to psychological safety. And you wrote a really, really great article with Professor Amy Edmondson on that topic. And You talk about that new forms of work have impacted psychological safety, and I think you've already alluded a bit to that. And one of the things you talk about is that we can no longer keep work and non-work discussions separate. Could you say something first, and then I want to go to your steps that you outlined, but how does this impact the job of a manager?
Well, I think one of the things that that we have to keep in mind, and I can say certainly if you look at it, I can say very clearly from a U.S. perspective, the U.S. has very, very clear rules, as do many places, but I can speak specifically to the U.S., very, very clear rules about what you can and can't have on the table, what you can and can't, you know, talk about. If I'm your boss, I can't ask you about your personal life. I can't ask you whether or not you have a partner, whether or not you have children. I can't ask you about whether you have aging parents nearby. I can't. All of that is off limits for very good reason. Why? If it's not on the table, it can't be a source of bias. At least that's the logic underlying it. So we have very clear boundaries and rules that say work is work, home is home, and bosses stay out of home, right? Because bad things happen there. If you get involved, I mean, not bad things don't happen there, bad things happen if you get involved. The challenge is, as we now are working hybrid, we can't do that anymore. I mean, mechanically, right? A, you see at least a small piece of my home right now. Now, let's be honest, and I'll pick on you for a second, right? You have a bookshelf behind you. It looks fantastic. You have a beautiful set of books. I know for a fact that every one of those books on the bookshelf behind you was curated. It was chosen because these are the messages and the themes of the book. That's smart business. That's a good idea. I have some maps up and things. I have a piece of art from my daughter when she was two. Fine, I've put those there. We all curate the image of what we produce. And we've done that in our offices for years, right? Which pictures do you put up? Do you put up the one where your kids look extra cute and things look wonderful and here's me showing up, you know, that sort of thing? Or do you leave your space a mess, et cetera? So one of the challenges in all this stuff is this sort of presentation and all that. But now as we are working hybrid and we are working in these sorts of environments, I also have some mechanical things, right? If I'm going to say, okay, we need an all hands meeting and it's going to be on Wednesday, I need to know whether or not you can make Wednesday, or whether you say, oh, but Wednesday is the day that, and you know, I'll use an example we used in the article, right? Maybe you say, look, I have a child who's having some challenges at school. Wednesday is their tutoring day. I can't be in on Wednesday because of that. I may or may not feel comfortable sharing that. I may say, well, actually, I can't do Wednesday because that's my mom, the night that I play bridge with my mom, and she's a widow, and so she can't, this is my chance. It's really important. It's special. Do you feel comfortable and safe sharing those things? Or I don't feel comfortable getting into the office because I have an underlying health condition and I'm nervous about maybe it's COVID or something else. Who knows what? The point being, as we now are including time working at home and we don't have clear boundaries of every day between these hours and these hours are owned by the office, we now have to have an intersection between home and work, and management has to have some data and knowledge. That's why Amy and I were arguing psychological safety is even more important now and has to be expanded, because traditionally psych safety has been looking at the domain of the work itself, asking technical questions. Are you comfortable challenging on these elements? Now we have to ask questions. Are you comfortable sharing about your personal life or private life, other things? Is there an environment where I feel safe enough to say, look, here's what I'm doing? Maybe it's even something as personal as I'm really feeling isolated and lonely. I'm feeling lost. And we've done some work on isolation and loneliness that shows this is increasing dramatically. One of the things you don't want to talk about when you're feeling lonely, typically, is the fact that you're feeling lonely, right? Well, hi, by the way, I'm suffering from something, I have mental illness, I have whatever else it is, a challenge, whatever it is. This is not typically what people raise their hand and say, let me shout this from the rooftops. You need to create psychological safety in order to bring this data on the table, because now this data actually affects your ability to do things like scheduling and coordination and the work that needs to get done and how people work together and what we offer them and support and you name it.
So this is super, super helpful. And in the article you outline, and I just recommend everyone to go and read the article on HBR, but you outline 5 steps. You talk about set the scene, lead the way, take baby steps, share positive examples, and be a watchdog. Mm-hmm. And just whatever you think is most important for us to get in terms of how do we actually do that?
In all those steps, right? Set the scene is really about making sure you have the data you've figured out. Leading the way is the one where I think it's really, really important, because the one thing I can't say to my employees is, hey, you should all share more. You shouldn't be scared to share, right? Well, of course, that's easy for me to say. I have all the power. Leading the way is critically important. And that means showing real vulnerability. So now we're not in the domain. You know what it's like when somebody in a job interview says, okay, Tobias, tell me, what's your biggest flaw? Well, my biggest flaw is I'm just too dedicated. I mean, come on, like we're not in that domain, right? Leading the way doesn't mean come up with some fluffy example of saying, oh yes, I also, it's difficult for me to work from home because I have my, you know, because I can't decide whether I want to work in my office, in the home office, or work on the boat. And I like, these are not the kinds of things we really want to get into. This is about showing real vulnerability. And it's something that is often very difficult for leaders to do, to honestly share what is actually scary for them. What are the real risks that they are facing? Getting that out there is the only way that you prove to your employees that it is safe to actually have these conversations. And then that's where the subsequent steps, it's also about providing evidence and data, right? So that is data, not just that people are sharing things, but look, this person shared and here's how it helped not only them, but all of us, and therefore why we support it. And again, the watchdog piece is exactly what I talked about before, the weakest link. You cannot let it slide. Even a well-intentioned thing that infringes on psychological safety, you need to at least bring it up, but you bring it up in a psychologically safe way. You say, hey, you know what? Actually, Tobias, the way you responded to your colleague, that was kind of, I can see how they would be threatened. But you frame it in a way to say, not that makes you a bad person, but you frame it in a way of saying, I'm telling you this so that you can try to correct. And you take it as saying, yikes, sorry about that. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to frame it that way. That's it. We all just accept that, look, everyone makes mistakes. It's okay. And we move past it. It's a way of creating that sort of an environment where dialogue is really encouraged and supported and rewarded when it actually happens.
Thank you so much for that, Mark. It's been a fascinating conversation. And just finally, I wanted to ask you, what are ways that people can follow you and keep learning from your work?
If people have follow-up questions I work with organizations all the time. Some of this work that Amy and Rob and I are doing also on employee value proposition, we are currently working with organizations, collecting data, et cetera. So if people are interested in this work, feel free to drop me an email. I'm sure you'll provide all that info. Feel free to reach out to me, and I'm always happy to chat about this. Other than that, LinkedIn and a little bit on Twitter, that sort of thing. Most articles of the things that I'm talking about, they're published in either HBR or Sloan Management Review. So a quick visit there, you can usually find it. And I can provide you with a couple of the links if that would be useful as well.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this conversation, it really means the world to us if you would share, rate, and review it on iTunes. We're super grateful for all the 5-star reviews and generous comments that we received so far. It really helps us take the message of purpose and integrity to a wider audience. And finally, don't forget to grab your free PDF on leadingtransformationalchange.com. See you in 2 weeks.